hard, hard net. We got virgin suicides and Hollywood homicides. Black Hawk down Pearl Harbor and oh, the faculty Wicker Park and here on Earth. And that's why we hard, Joshua Daniel Hartnett.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of We Heart Hartnett, the podcast that explores the filmography of the actor Josh Hartnett, movie by movie. I am one of your three hosts, Patrick Willems.
I'm Matthew Torpy.
And I'm Jacob Torpy.
But we're brothers. You can call him Matt and Jake. That's
the brother. I like the brothers Torpy. That's what I've been trying to, like, get
brothers
across.
Brothers Torpy. We'll see. Hashtag the brothers Torpy.
Yeah.
That could catch on.
Yeah.
And but as I'm sure you know, because it's in the title of the episode, today we are talking about a pretty important film of the past 20 years, The Virgin Suicides, the first film written for the screen and directed by Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
Adapted from the book by Jeffrey Eugenides.
That's the pronunciation. I was going to ask this question already.
Eugenides?
I just didn't know. And it's, I knew I was going to butcher it if
it's
I tried
Greek,
to say
it's
it.
Greek, so it's like very
Eugenides.
Much Eugenides. Yeah.
Okay.
And it stars Kirsten Dunst, who would become, you know, a frequent collaborator with Sofia Coppola,
mm-hmm.
As well as James Woods,
yep.
Kathleen Turner.
Kathleen Turner.
And our boy, the man himself, Josh Hartnett, as Trip Fontaine.
Trip Fontaine.
We're two for two now on Josh Hartnett having amazing names in movies. Because we got Trip Fontaine. We also have Zeke. And do we remember what Zeke's last name is?
Oh, I'll look this up right now.
Yeah, because we've seen Halloween Water. And we watched and we watched The Faculty. And again, Josh Hartnett is given, you know, the role of the sort of slouchy, dreamy ne'er-do-well.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
although this one more dreamy and slouchy than ne'er-do-well.
Yeah, in the previous two, he played like the more like, you know, I think evergreen cool concept of like the mm-hmm. slacker, precocious,
yeah.
you know, like
yeah.
kid.
Messy bowl cut, sitting in the back of the classroom.
By the way, in The Faculty, he's Zeke Tyler.
Zeke Tyler, yeah.
And I think one thing that's pretty key that we should point out here is that he has different hair this time.
Yep,
well,
he went
70s.
He went full Lord Farquaad.
Yeah,
he's Farquaad.
Really tall Lord Farquaad now.
And assuming that this was made right after the other two, it's probably a wig.
Yeah, I would have to guess. He is really tall Lord Farquaad with bell bottoms, and I could not get that image out of my head the entire
yeah.
time
you,
I was watching
you,
this.
I didn't think of this, but
kiss
you just
me.
Ruined
mm.
it for me.
Yeah. I was really hoping that he would say that to Lux on
yeah.
the football field.
But this is also, you know, this is near the end of Hartnett's run as a teen. Because, you know, he started playing teens in movies and, you know, and then, you know, probably like a year or so after this,
yeah.
he was entering the realm of playing adults.
A young
How
adult
old is
film.
He in this one?
He's supposed to be, I want to just say, a senior in high school.
18. Well, no, but I mean, how old is he in real life?
Oh, well.
20. He was 20 years old when he made this.
Damn.
So crazy.
Yeah, he's born in 78.
Okay.
And this came out in 99, so it would have been shot in 98. So, yeah, he's 20. And, yeah, because, you know, obviously I'm just giving away our future episodes, but anyone can know those by looking at
the filmography.
yeah.
Don't go on Wikipedia.
Please. Please don't.
Because after this, there's Here on Earth, where
right.
I think he's also a teen. Then there's 2001, his big year, where he's got Blow Dry, but then also...
Oh, we'll get to that.
Oh, God.
We'll get to Blow Dry. Be excited about that episode.
Fuck, man, that movie.
But then also, like, Black Hawk Down and
yeah.
Pearl Harbor,
yeah.
where he's there as, like, an adult leading
mm-hmm.
man.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, we're talking The Virgin Suicides. And
yeah.
Had you guys seen this movie before?
Yes.
Same. And I think me and Matt are in the same boat in that we both saw it, but it was a long time ago. Like
and
more than 10 years ago.
I saw the movie first and then I read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know. I read it in high school, I'm pretty sure, the book.
Mm-hmm.
At once.
So you got a leg up on Jake and I, because
yeah. I'm trying to get at the fact that I remember almost nothing.
Right. Do you remember any differences? I
just
think that's the key thing.
Well, like Eugenides, I don't know. Did you read Middlesex?
Okay, so Eugenides, he's one of these guys. I always saw Middlesex in bookstores, And that was one of those books that at the time that it came out, like, it just, it seemed so critically lauded that it made me annoyed.
You were a contrarian?
Yeah, for no reason other than it just looked stuffy. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to read it.
And go, no. You know what? Storm out of the bookstore.
It was like The Glass Castle. That was another book that I always saw on shelves. I was like, not going
to
read it.
Or was it trying to like
the cover of it?
Was it trying to be like fun, like Middlemarch? Like, was it trying to do like a literary allusion to that or something?
I don't know.
To like stuffy literature that you would think if you were in high school?
Yeah, maybe something about the word Middlesex sounded like a town and like sleepy, you know, English countryside.
Right.
And
well, the key is that I think
I was like, this is stodgy.
That book also takes place in Michigan, which is where the Virgin Suicides takes place, right?
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I think it's right. Like, it's like, you know, it's basically because I think Eugenides grew up in the 70s in Michigan. I think right as the, you know, auto industry was kind of taking a turn for the worse, and Detroit started to become more and more known as, you know, a kind of dangerous, you know,
the place that would spawn RoboCop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was the downturn of that place economically, I think. And so Virgin Suicides is also set in that context, I'm pretty sure, of just before things started to go south.
Well, they mentioned the downfall of the automobile industry right at the beginning narration of the movie, too.
Right,
and it's like a throwaway line. Well, just they mention it and don't ever really come back to it, but it's
there,
funny. But,
and there's also that idea that, like, the, you know, the suicides of these teen girls is kind of, like, representative of the beginning of, like, things changing.
A general downfall.
Yeah. So that was, like, the only symbolic significance I could put to, you know, what's already said in the title of the book.
But from what you remember, is the movie a fairly faithful adaptation?
Yeah, what they do is they kind of just excise like certain sequences that were longer, okay, basically. And there's a lot more, like, you know, I think psychological analysis of the girls. But it's a pretty short book, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because I saw the movie, I think, like, maybe 11 years ago. I remember watching it just by myself, like, early on my freshman year of college, and then doing as research for a different project a couple of years ago. I rewatched all of Sofia Coppola's movies except for Somewhere, because I hate Somewhere. I her worst movie by far.
It's a snooze. It's a surefire snooze.
I mean, it's just like, what if you took Lost in Translation, but then removed everything funny or interesting about it?
Well, I have a question. So Giovanni Ribisi, right, does the VO narration for this inexplicably, because he's not in the movie, and it's unclear who he is. He's like some omniscient kid.
He's one of the kids, but you never know for sure which one it is.
Right, and it's definitely not any of the actors, because he's not in it.
Right.
So it's just weirded me out.
And I think we're getting into here, I think, a thing that we kind of all agree with. So, like, I like this movie.
Me too. Yeah.
And we all like it, but we're also all a little bit baffled by it. And just in different ways, in terms of, like what it's about.
Yeah.
And really what it's saying. And I was thinking about this while watching it. And there's all these sort of more, slightly more conventional narrative approaches that the movie just avoids. And one of the really obvious ones, because it's all narrated from the present, at, you know, by a character who's like one of the young guys in the movie, like looking back and reflecting on this whole period and on these girls. But the narrator isn't even really a character, because you don't know. It seems like the obvious thing to do would be center the movie on one of the guys and his perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Like The Sandlot.
Or Stand By Me or something.
Or Stand By Me, yeah. And then have it be his perspective on it. But you have this narrator who is never linked up to any of the guys. So the guys all kind of blur together because, you know, outside of, I mean, Trip Fontaine is his own guy. And,
right.
And then there's
Trip Fontaine
is Josh Hartnett.
Is Josh Hartnett.
Josh Hartnett.
And in this movie is like one of the seminal events.
Yeah. Oh, he the thing is with this, the long stretch.
Literally seminal event. Get
oh.
It? Nice.
That's a jizz joke.
Yeah.
Courtesy Matt Torvey.
Yes, always.
But it's funny because, you know, you have, so there is not really the central character. There's just a voiceover. There's a narrator who doesn't really like, correspond to any of the main characters, or any of the guys, and then, mm-hmm. and so none of the guys are really the main character. They're just this group of boys.
Yeah. Yep.
And then, well, I mean, one of them is young Hayden Christensen, yeah. which it was a hilarious discovery. And he still was going to like grow like a foot yeah. like in the next 3 years, but you can recognize the voice.
All the pieces were there though. Yeah. He looked like
yeah,
him.
But for instance, like, since this is, the movie is this outside perspective looking in mm-hmm. at the girls.
Yes.
I mean, the Lisbon sisters. Oh, by the way, if you haven't seen the movie, it's about, there's this family, the Lisbons, and their dad is James Woods. He's the math teacher in the high school. Their mom is Kathleen Turner. They're very conservative. They're religious. The parents are very protective. And they have, like, this flock of beautiful teen girls, all blonde.
Yeah.
And the youngest one kills herself, and then
inexplicably by jumping out of the second story window of their house
and landing on their like spiky metal fence,
which is so brutal.
Which
it's
honestly,
a nasty death.
I laughed a little bit at that scene because it seemed like a really weird indirect dig at Todd Rundgren, because their party was so lame, and that song was playing like right before she excuses herself. She's like, they all go downstairs and they're having this awkward party. It's her birthday party.
Well, the thing is, you have to say, she made an attempt on her life first.
Yes.
And failed. Right. And then this was like, they're nervously trying to like get back to like normal.
Because Danny DeVito, the like counselor, who was also a producer on the movie.
Yeah.
He was like, maybe she should have some social interactions with boys her age.
He's like, hey.
What does this look like to you?
Rum ham. She should drink some rum ham.
Anyway, yeah, so that's the brothers Torpy doing Danny DeVito.
We like Always Sunny, but anyways.
Rorschach.
But yeah, and yeah, he does give her a Rorschach test.
Uh-huh.
And but yeah, so that's it. And then so because she tried to kill herself before, and they had this party, they invite over some neighborhood boys. Mm-hmm. And then she really does kill herself.
Kills herself because they have a kid with Down syndrome come over as, like, a gesture of, I think, kindness.
Right.
And then the kids, like, sort of lightly start teasing him, and that's kind of, seems like it pushed her over the edge.
It is, but it's also one of those things where it's, like, they're sort of nice to him.
Yeah.
But then
not
also,
really.
Well, it's like, they're not really antagonistic to him, but they're, like, they're, like, having fun at his expense, but also in a way that he enjoys as well.
Yeah, it's lighthearted and, like, dance. It straddles, like, a gray area where you can't tell at all.
Maybe.
Right. There's, like, a little bit of patronizing thing going on.
It's not, like, really mean-spirited.
No.
And but then she kills herself, and then the parents get more and more increasingly protective.
James Wood, though, when he finds her out there, I know
he's so good in this whole movie.
James Wood,
he's highlight.
He's like a true piece of garbage in real life, but man, he's good in this movie.
Yeah,
he's a great actor. It's just like yeah, and he totally captures the dad who's just like willfully oblivious and square as hell.
Oh,
and
he's such a comedic highlight.
And bowled over by his wife. Like he's not as religious as her. That's another dynamic. Right. Is like she really like. She runs the house, and like,
she's the one that you know has Kirsten Dunst burn her rock records. When she goes, not Kiss,
not Aerosmith,
Aerosmith, please. That scene was
funny,
a laugh out loud scene. Also, that's when I officially decided like the biggest thing about having watched this movie in high school was and not having really any clear memory of it besides like very like. Just like still images almost of like scenes that I kind of remembered was I forgot how funny this movie is. This movie's really funny.
It is.
And
for
super
a movie
on
about,
purpose,
about teens
so, yeah.
killing themselves in a variety of ways.
Oh my God. And that record scene was like such a, like when
and
they
the
start
house filling
coughing,
with smoke
and when Kathleen Turner opens the door and the amount of smoke that comes out of her house as she like,
it's like they were hotboxing in there.
It's so funny.
Well, this is something that actually I did notice about Eugenides, because he's, I don't know how old he was when he published this, and then Middlesex, and then I guess the last thing I read was The Marriage Plot, which mm-hmm. which also mostly focuses on a, you know, young female perspective.
Yeah.
Is he writes in the perspective of women and young people,
mm-hmm.
and it's weird because he's like, I'm pretty sure like a 30-year-old Greek man at the time or whatever, mm-hmm. and he's... I can't, you know, obviously I innately can't speak to this experience, but I think he does a pretty good job of just capturing the stifling suburban young person thing. But like, you know, the line, like, you know, how can you be so miserable? And then the young daughter is like, clearly you've never been a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, neither has Jeffrey Eugenides, but like,
right. But and you've got to say, like, you know, this did speak to Sofia Coppola in some way, where like, yeah, when she was, I don't know, probably in her late 20s. I can't remember how old she was when she made this. She was like, this is the thing that I want to make as my first movie.
Yeah. Wait, is Giovanni Ribisi, sorry, is he like weirdly connected to the Coppolas the way that Nick Cage is?
Or Jason Schwartzman?
Well, Nick Cage is a Coppola, and Jason Schwartzman is a Coppola.
Yeah. Right, but you know, like, they don't tote the last name.
But yeah. Is Ribisi also a
He's got to have some connection. Well, also, because he does also play, in quotes, Spike Jones in, yeah, Lost in Translation, where he's great.
The beat keeps evolving. That's a different guy, but yeah, that guy's really funny.
Like, I love Giovanni Ribisi in Lost in Translation almost as much as I love Anna Faris in Lost in Translation.
Oh my god, yeah.
She's pretty,
yeah,
solid.
Exactly.
But to your point, though, I wanted to talk about a little bit the structure of the movie, which is also another thing that kept me confused.
Oh, yeah.
You were talking about the voiceover narration from a distance.
And I realized I didn't actually, not to like cut you off. But
right, right.
Shut up.
But the thing that I was basically getting at is that there is, you know, it's this movie looking back from the present,
mm-hmm,
but you never get a sense of the person looking back isn't really a character. And then, for instance, there's the one kind of odd scene. There's one scene set in the present where you see middle-aged Tripp Fontaine,
yeah,
played by Michael Paré. And who's, like, in a rehab clinic.
Yep.
And so it almost seems like that could have been a structural device for the whole movie.
Being interviewed
yeah, maybe by the narrator.
Right. But then
you hear the narrator's inference. Don't you hear the narrator's voice and it's... Did I hallucinate that, or was it female?
No. That's one of, like, the nurses.
Oh, okay, all right.
Who's like, it's time for time something.
Time for your, like, wellness meeting.
Yeah, yeah, but that's one of the things that's funny about it, because it's, your like, it gives you session, hints, yeah, of what seems like a more obvious structural device. It's like, oh, like this, you know, this one guy, he's like middle-aged, still, he's still obsessing over this. He's, you know, finds like, he like tracks down different people from, like, you know, that he knew back then. They all reflect on it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really commit to that. And I'll say that's a problem, because they clearly made the choice to avoid that, but they have like hints, and there's like a semblance of, you know, of this narrative device that seems like it would have been a more obvious choice.
I can't remember if the book does that, so that it might have been one of these things where Sofia Coppola, she, in her overeagerness as a first feature, added a confusing amount of things from the book that she should have took artistic license to edit out, mm-hmm, or make more consistent. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Yeah, it's just kind of funny that there's like a 1 minute scene set in the present, and that's it.
Yeah, it happens twice.
Twice. Tripp Fontaine comes back two times.
Oh, right.
Right,
but he's the only person you see in the present,
mm-hmm, and just gives us. And also, he just gives us. He's a weird. Like, he's. I mean, I'm sure he's supposed to be a sleaze.
Yeah.
In the present, as an alcoholic, but like, yeah, he also just gives that weird thing. Like, I never loved anyone as much as I loved that 17-year-old girl when I was 17 or whatever.
Right. Yeah. But hold on. I'm just like, is that Michael Paré?
Or she's 15 or something.
She's 14 or 15. Yeah. When the movie's set. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's part of the funny thing about it, because there's no main character.
Mm-mm. No, that's right, yeah.
And
I think that was a little... I have to imagine that was obviously a conscious choice.
It has to be,
When I was watching it, too, like, you guys were mentioning the fact that it was almost impossible to keep straight, like, who of the young boys was the narrator, who was the main character, should there be a focus on
anyone?
Because
they don't really tell you.
And they don't really tell you. And I was starting to get a vibe, and this is an odd movie to compare it to, but I thought it was intentional in the same way that... in American Psycho, it's intentional for all of the people that work at the firm that Christian Bale works at to kind of look vaguely the same.
Right.
And that you're supposed to sort of think of them more... like, it's more of a commentary generically on...
One of them is Jared Leto.
Yeah, I know. One of them's the guy from Big Love who plays the creepy compound brother, and I can't remember his name.
I've never seen that show.
Gavin Belson from...
Oh, yeah.
What's...
Silicon Valley.
Anyways.
Oh. But then in that book, there's like a really like,
yeah,
almost on the nose sort of theme,
right,
about the interchangeability and blah, blah, blah.
Right. I mean, like, it's a satire.
Yeah.
But I just figured you were supposed to maybe think of like the boys in like an aggregate sense. Like, this is just like maybe
they're
like,
just generic.
They're just
boys.
Generic, I think it's suburban like, boys, like, dealing with, you know...
Because Eugenides is, like, you know, he's, like, a guy, he's a writer who takes himself seriously, he's, like, on the literary scene. I think my only proffering... The only thing I'm proffering is, like, maybe it's about just, like, at a very specific time and place in a specific socioeconomic strata, the male and female, like, just sort of basic principles at, like, you know, meeting
each
other.
Right, and, like, and, like, these, like, confusing, baffling creatures that teen girls are to like, boys of that age.
Because this movie kind of unsettled me the first time I saw it, partially because, yeah, there was nothing to hold on to. It was just these, like, basically characters who were just kind of like atomized, and they just sort of interconnected and interacted, and there's no viewpoint.
Yeah.
So you were never settled down. But yeah, it definitely captured, I don't know, did you guys ever have like, were there some misty, not necessarily even like young girls like living in on your block that you were obsessed with or whatever, but like
I
just weird people.
Because I lived in the middle
of
nowhere.
Yeah, you lived in the boonies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We lived in New Jersey, and like I remember, we hated these people. We weren't like obsessed in a weird way, but there was the there was this like very uptight conservative household, and they had two daughters who were kind of mean to us.
Oh gosh!
I'm not gonna like name names, but like I definitely remember that presence on a you know a very suburban block in New Jersey, and it was weird. And the mom was like very much like Catherine Turner, like very like severe and would give you a weird stink eye if you were talking to them, their daughters.
And a key thing is, like, for us especially, this was the point in our lives before you could just be like, well, you know, I bet I could find him on Facebook.
Yeah.
You just had to stare across the street into their house and wonder.
Right.
That was all you had going for you.
Yeah, and it's one of the things, like, I would be fascinated to see this story if it were more centered on... like a character's an actual character's perspective, and what that would look like. But it's funny because the perspective kind of shifts, you know, as it goes on, because it's like it'll return to, you know, like the sort of like the general vagueness of like the boys.
Yeah.
But then like
the
when
boys.
But when when Trip Fontaine shows up, because there's this point like when the first daughter kills herself, and she does that. It's over the summer, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then no one sees them for a while. And then at the beginning of the school year, the sisters all return to school.
The remaining four. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's when. And so Kirsten Dunst plays Lux.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great name, Lux Lisbon. Excellent alliterative name.
And they do the thing that they also did in The Faculty, where they freeze frame on each one and then have their name written in a specific script.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I like that. That's still fun
right,
to
but,
me.
But here... Yeah, but it has a very different tone here. Like, I love the way that the title appears in this movie.
Yeah.
Where it's basically... It's like notebook doodles.
Yeah.
And so the title appears in a million different handwritten fonts, like, in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just want to... You know, I'm going to get nerdy about this. So this movie is shot by Ed Lockman, the same guy who shoots all of Todd Haynes' films. And there's this beautiful, like, hazy, like, warm glow to so much of it.
It's amazingly shot. And even in the, like, even, like, weird little techniques where they sort of change the template and feel of the film they're doing. So it's more like home videos out on the road.
Right.
Or, like, photographs taken around the world. Like, I loved the way that they sort of played around with
all the styles. And a lot of, as someone who is, like, I have very particular feelings about the use of crossfades. And I mean, crossfades can be so hacky.
Yeah, for sure.
And this makes great use of crossfades. You know, like the close-ups of like Kirsten Dunst's face, like at sunset, but then like crossfaded with the sky and stuff like that. There's like
she winks right to a ding noise, right?
That
happens
in the same scene. She there is a like post-production animated glint in her back frame, but then in like a shot later, there is actually winks and there's like a ding.
It's crazy because so Lux is, as far as I'm concerned, Lux and Trip Fontaine are like two of the closest to main characters we get.
I agree.
And
yes.
So she gets top billing. She's the one that's always in all the weird fantasy cut-throughs with the fades and the crossfades.
Well, she's also the only one of them who seems like sexual in any way.
Right.
Yeah.
Because she's actually like dating guys and hooking up with people. They're like fascinated by the rest of them, but Lux is like like lecherous. She's like, you know, you look at like the scene where the one kid is invited over for, because apparently like their dad is like, well, they should socialize with some boys. That's what the psychologist said. And he like will just invite just random like boys from his classes to dinner at their house.
Yeah.
And so he has, so the boy has to go to the bathroom, but they're like downstairs bathroom is broken. So he has to go to the one upstairs that's through one of the daughter's rooms.
Yeah.
And he goes in and is like fascinated because he's looking around because these girls are like mysteries. And they're so guarded by their parents. And then Lux comes in and she's like taking her cardigan off. So she just has like a tank top. Like thin straps.
And the boys, all of the boys in this movie are so hilariously awkward.
Yeah.
The casting was so great. It's great. Just thought everybody did it.
But
really
she is
well.
Also so aware of the effect that she has on people. And so she's like loving all of this because she loves how awkward he is and like the attention that she gets, but the rest of them and there's some parts where you can kind of see the rest of them like, you know, kind of like roll their eyes at her a little bit because she's like going for it in the way that none of the others are.
Right. Yeah,
there's like they're excited when they get to go to homecoming, but they don't seem interested in boys.
Yeah, they don't want to drink the peach schnapps.
Yeah, but she does.
They don't
the other thing that it kind of suggests that I was curious about is like, did Lux maybe convince everyone else to kill themselves? Could she potentially be responsible and have the like silver tongue that convinced everyone that maybe it was a good idea?
You know, that is a totally valid theory that we won't really know because the movie only delves so far into their personal lives. Like as much time as the movie spends, you know, like showing scenes of them in their homes, we don't seem to be doing a lot of like, they're not talking a lot in their homes, mostly just like laying about or reading
or watching TV, watching nature programs with their mom.
Like the movie never delves very far into their psychology because since they are unknowable to the boys, they're kind of unknowable to us.
Within their framework of their perspective,
But getting back to like the overall narrative, so they go back to school and then Luxter starts like, you know, she'll
flirting
like,
and
like flirting and like making out with guys and also, my favorite of the boys.
The boys is
Chase. The kind of the short, kind of funny.
Yeah, he's the best.
Thank you for keeping their names straight.
Yeah,
because I certainly couldn't.
He's the only one whose name I remember. I looked at him and I was like, this kid looks familiar. What have I seen him in?
He's adorable.
He's in like nothing
other than
this. Yeah. But he also, his locker is right next to one of the Lisbon sisters.
I think the oldest.
I don't think it's the oldest.
Well, we're fighting.
We are.
I don't know.
You and me are done professionally. but he like tries to talk to her, and she's like, no.
Yeah,
like you don't have to.
You're a manlet.
He's so tiny. Nah.
Yeah, but he's the best one.
Yeah.
And but they'll like we'll look out the window and see like Lux like making out with some like idiot
skipping class.
And they're always like the dumb guys that she's into, and they have these little, like
until the hottest dumb guy.
Yeah,
I don't know if they ever make clear Trip Fontaine's smart,
but
high a lot.
They also do these little like interview things where like they show like them like they're clearly like asking around these guys. They're like, oh, what can you tell us? And they're all just like idiots. And they're like, well, you want to smell my fingers?
Oh god, this is what I mean. Like the movie was way funnier than I thought it was going to be. I just remembered it being all dark and broody.
And that's like, Sofia Coppola's movies are all funny.
The kid that was, I think, the kid that's like wears the sunglasses all the time.
Oh my god!
Struts around the dough on, and he's just holding onto the fence of the tennis court, like watching them play sports.
The Italian kid,
I love you. Like he just says it like out loud to himself because he just can't.
There's a thing where it sets up that maybe the youngest one who kills herself first got the idea from this. There's like this Italian exchange student who's just this kid, and he's like, if you pictured like, okay, Italian kid in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, he's got like polo shirt with like.
Nothing could be more stereotypical than what happened.
Maybe like the logo of like some soccer team, you know, like. The wavy dark hair, tan skin, aviator sunglasses,
high-waisted jeans that fell bottom way
and
out,
and cool like flares. And there's an expression of his love for some girl. Oh, this part's so funny. He jumps off the second story of his house, and there's this really wide shot. You see him fall into the bushes. He just gets up and walks away.
He just emerges from the bushes.
He walks away in the same, like, swaggery stride that he's had earlier.
This kid is, like, so good.
He didn't even slightly twist his ankle.
Yeah.
What was the other kid with the slicked back hair who also wore sunglasses, though? Because he was amazing.
There is the Italian kid whose family has, like, mob connections.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, he has the doesn't he have braces?
Mm.
Or he has, like, seems like he has something on his teeth.
Just food.
And maybe it's just food.
I don't know.
I thought it looked like constantly. He had some kind of dental appliance that he was also trying to, like, hide with his lips. But he has, like, the ultra slicked back dark hair, and he talks, you know, like he's from, like, he literally looks like a kid version of one of the Sopranos.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm trying. He looks like is it Michael from the Sopranos that he looks like?
The more rodential looking guy.
Who is the guy in The Sopranos who was like writing the screenplay that he's trying to get sold?
I don't know.
And he looks like a kid version of him.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you know, he's confident and, like, you know, has, like, a lot of personality, and so, like, the fairly, like, dorky, confused, like, main kids, like, listen to him.
Yeah.
But wasn't it like he saw, like, one of his, like, relatives has, like, an escape tunnel to get to New Jersey or something like that.
I could go through the sewers and get into anyone's house.
Get to anyone's basement. Yeah. It's like he saw one of them in their underwear one time or something like that.
He also, during the party when the youngest kills herself, he, like, kind of hits on Kathleen Turner. Or, like, he hits on the mom. He's like, this punch is really good. Mm.
What's in it?
Wow.
You know, like orange and pineapple. And he's like,
I love pineapple.
I love pineapple.
And then he just walks away and, like, while maintaining eye contact with her the whole time. Did I forget that he fucks the mom or something?
Is this going to happen later?
Is this going to happen?
That kid is fantastic. Is he Paul Baldino? Is that the character's name?
Are you looking at a Sopranos list now?
No, I'm not. I'm looking at IMDb for Virgin
Suicides. Sometimes we have to wrangle each other so that we don't go off on huge tangents of just, like, loose connection.
Side note, if we could get a sponsorship for this podcast from IMDb, because I cannot overstate how often every single day I use the IMDb app. It is, I'm not even, like, really shilling here. It is along with, like, Gmail, Twitter, and weather, like, my most used apps.
Weather.
Anyway.
Also, it's never too early to ask, hey, Josh, come on the pod.
Yeah, Josh Hartnett. Josh,
I heard you just sold your $3 million loft or apartment or whatever.
In New York.
Penthouse apartment in New York.
Yeah, look, Jake's got a spare bed. Crash at Jake's place.
That didn't sound creepy at all. I have a spare bed.
No, I'm just saying.
What are you, 6'4"? Yeah, that'll work.
He sold his place in New York.
Scooby-Doo?
Look, he sold his place in New York.
For Scoobs.
We're not going to ask him to, like, we don't have the budget to put him up in a hotel if he comes in. But, Jake, you'd let Josh crash at your place, right?
Of course I would.
Josh, you can crash here. It's fine. And we're all a bunch of sweeties.
One of the things I pride myself most on is my mental stability. So, just so you know.
And I may be the most humble person I know. So.
Yeah. I really related to that song because I'm the most humble person I know.
So anyway.
Popstar, a great movie.
Oh my God.
We're getting up to the key point here, though, where Mr. Fontaine shows up.
Exactly.
So let's talk about
Is Josh Hartnett on Twitter?
I don't know.
Because you know how
you're going to add him right now?
Well, you know how Go On Chapo is like a meme on Twitter?
Yeah.
I'd love it if
or Go On Cumtown.
I didn't know that was a thing, but I would love it if Go On We Heart Hartnett could be a thing.
Oh, God, yeah. Come on.
Oh, God.
Oh, God, yeah. If we're not selling it at this very moment, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about Josh Hartnett's character is like...
He's not on... Wait. No, he's trying to.
Joshua Hartnett who is verified on Twitter, and his at is at Dartichall.
What?
And we will delete this because I already don't.
That guy's a professional gamer.
Yeah.
He's sponsored by.
He has a headset on.
Yeah, that guy's playing Overwatch or League of Legends, it says.
Yeah.
He's Echo Fox. Just so in case anyone wants to know, there's a Josh Hartnett who's a League of Legends gamer with 49,000 followers. I'm sure some of you already know this.
He's a good proxy person to follow, though.
Echo Fox.
Yeah, but our podcast is not about him.
Echo Fox, GG.
It's about the actor. The actor who plays the character that we're just getting to.
Trip Fontaine.
The guy, the really important person that... The guy that Lux is resistant to.
Right,
who
because he's
break
so...
through her walls. Yeah. Despite being the smoothest, the sexiest guy in school, the guy who shed his baby fat over the summer and now is the object of affection of every female in the school.
Can I ask again? Did anyone know anyone like that? Like the guy who was like awkward, like Neville Longbottomed his way out of being weird,
and it
like,
took Neville Longbottom years.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Or Josh, Drake, and Josh, whatever.
Neville Longbottom had to like
who
like
Josh
fight
packed
people
his
and
way.
Kill people.
Did
in
he
a
go
giant
to war?
Wizard battle.
Oh,
yeah, in the Deathly Hallows. Right? Yeah.
I thought you meant to like.
He becomes like a war. He went to military.
Oh, you mean he's part of friggin' Dumbledore's
right.
army?
But no, yeah. but I can't recall. At least in our high school, was there like a Trip Fontaine character?
No.
I guess no.
Trip
not
Fontaine
really.
Is not a real like. He's very. An idealized. He's kind of like the sisters in a few weird ways because they don't really give him a ton of background either.
Well, he's Lux's like counterpart,
but he has gay dads.
He does have.
Oh
gay
yeah, yeah.
Which is a fascinating detail that you only get in one scene.
I think
who
that might
hire him out.
I think that might be another thing that's like more expanded on in the books. I can't quite remember.
Yeah, his two dads only get one scene where they try to give him helpful
advice,
and he just is not having it. He's so tired, and he's just clearly heard it all before, like the dads have given him.
And he's such a needy boy, you see, after a while. He's like, the one girl, like, kind of is just like, nah, thanks. And he just is talking to his gay dads, he's like, dads, am I handsome? And they're like, yeah, oh, sweetie, like, just like, you know, just like be confident, be yourself. He's like, yeah, I guess.
And then he lazes about on his pool float and sips his like
just,
soda pop.
Okay,
I
feel like we could devote a whole episode to just the introduction of Trip Fontaine.
Well, let's just say.
It's great. It's amazing. It's like, I almost wish this was his first movie. Because that is a goddamn movie star entrance.
Mm-hmm. It's so good.
Like,
and it's happened probably a bunch in film, right? Like that sort of the BMOC walking through the halls, everyone's heads turning. But this outdid it.
When he arrives like late to school again.
Yeah,
like,
high.
Goes to the office.
He's high.
And he's smoking the marijuana.
Yeah,
and he goes
fat fucking doinks.
He goes to the office and then just charms his way out of getting penalized.
Yeah. Well, he's so hot.
He literally like brushes the side of the like desk attendant's hair, and she's like, "I guess this time." And he's like, "Thanks, baby." And then he walks down the halls.
I feel like that would work on literally anybody, regardless of gender or sexual orientation.
Yeah.
It also
like
seems
he could do that to any of us and we would be like, yeah, sure.
All right, man. Fine, just go.
Trip's gonna be... I'm not tripping. Anyway, get on in there.
And then you have
you're tripping if you write me
that incredible shot where he like walks through the door and the camera just tracks down like him walking toward the camera. Him on the left side of the frame and like the row of women at lockers on the right side of the frame as every girl turns to look at him as he has the leather jacket slung over his shoulder.
And he flips his hair back.
And those purple tinted sunglasses.
Yes. And they hold that shot and milk it.
Mm-hmm. There's like 30 girls he walks by and every single one of them turns their head and some of them look like their minds fucking blown, like their mouths drop open. It's really funny.
How is he real?
Yeah.
And then it gets better because then he slips into his class late and you see the teacher like eye him and then they rack focus to the girls the students in the class and they look at him and he slides in behind Lux.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Who doesn't look... The only one who doesn't look bad.
Doesn't look at him.
Well, hold
up. She does...
When he slides into that class, it seemed like in that scene...
Oh, that was different,
he's
yeah.
just wandering around high when class is in session.
Yeah.
And what he apparently does is, like, even when he gets to school late, he just kind of, like, stumbles through the empty hallways very sexily. And then the principal, like, turns a corner... And he's like, whoop, and just slips into a class like he does probably with every class, which is just sort of like sneak in like 30 minutes into it already.
Right.
And then he accidentally sees Lux. It's not a class that he's meant
to. In that first montage, I will say, yeah, I don't think they go to that just yet. I think first it's like, you know, you get the part where the girl...
And Barracuda's playing, should mention.
And Barracuda's playing. Where the girl, she bakes him... What did she bake him?
Oh, gosh. I can't remember.
I made you brownies, and also here's the answers to the test for tomorrow.
Oh, no. That's it. She brings him that, and he enters the door in a towel.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and then when he goes into the class
he's
late,
like, come on in.
And the teacher, like, basically almost blows him a kiss, and then, like, all the other girls are looking at him. He's, like, just, like, smiling and, like, nodding, and then all of a sudden it cuts to a girl pushing with her foot the answers to the test he was late for across the floor to him, and he just like smiles like, of course this is happening.
It's great, but what's also key about Trip Fontaine is there isn't anything really like malicious or threatening or mean about him. It's just, he's just a guy who lucked into amazing genes and is just like,
yeah,
you know, living his life to the fullest right now.
Yeah, he's like, clearly, I think partially why they maybe kept the cut, the weird cut to the present him in AA, is to show, like, what happens, tends to happen to people that literally peak in high school, and how,
right,
he, you know, hey, look, he is a waste case. He's fucking, you know, zooted out of his head, and he's just stumbling around the halls and going into random classrooms. Like, it is pathetic in a way.
There's also the great shot of him just, like, on, like, the pool, like, floating thing. With the zoom lens where they just pull back and just laying in the pool. Mm-hmm. Just thinking, I'm Trip Fontaine.
Probably, yeah, just thinking about him and his name.
I'm Trip Fontaine.
Right. If someone's going to have that name, I feel like they're just going to become that.
Yeah, sure don't name your kid Trip Fontaine going down the line.
And I mean, exactly. Hartnett had, it seemed like, you know, many years and a couple movies under his belt in which to perfect this particular character.
Right.
And he's really, like, delivering the, like, you know, final thesis statement on this whole act.
It feels like there's a progression, because you've got, you know, Halloween Water, where he's just like, you know, teen who like breaks some rules, but there's not much of a character.
Yeah.
But he's like
loves his mom.
Loves his mom, and he skips the class trip. There's not a lot there, but he like does the most with it that anyone could. And then the faculty, it's like a step forward. It's like a similar character, but he's like, he's edgier. He like breaks more rules.
Yeah. He jacks his fellow students up. Jacks them up. Gets him so jacked for class.
Yeah. He's like bad at school, but good at science.
Yeah.
And there was that. And then Trip Fontaine, you know, that just seemed like, okay, let's take his like slacker student, but make it iconic. And Trip Fontaine feels like an iconic character. He is the most iconic character in this movie.
Yeah. He basically is, except for Lux.
Lux, is, I feel like, is a big focal point.
She is.
But she's less accessible the whole time.
She is.
Because
yeah.
Well, you're always watching her from a distance.
Idiot.
You never really understand her. And you understand Trip Fontaine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do we want to talk about the dance sequence then, or the prom? Because I feel like that was the big middle section.
It's a homecoming.
Homecoming, sorry.
Wait, no, well, because this is like
up in my head.
Well, yeah, we should, because that's really the end of the Trip Fontaine section of the movie.
Right. So we've gotten through a lot of the,
Okay. Let me just speed through some of the story elements.
Yeah.
So Trip Fontaine, he's really into Lux, but she just like won't give him the time of day until he like slides into her
class
DMs.
No, come on.
And bro. They're all in the auditorium watching some educational film, and this is a great scene.
It is a great scene.
Where, because it's just a long, long shot where he just sits next to her in the auditorium and then finally manages to kind of like wear her down. Or just like get in. He gets in with
her. Wear her down sounds predatory. Like
it
she's
does.
Cool. They're both like they are both enjoying it.
Right, yeah. But there's also the great
thing.
She's
like Fat Chance.
Where you know,
smiles.
Her hand is like on the armrest, and then he moves his hand on the armrest, and they like slide together and they're almost gonna hold hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
a weird noise comes out of them. I think it's the, is it the movie they're watching? An odd noise?
Or like
of?
The guy behind
them? No, there's like a dude. He's like, trip, bro!
Yeah, there's just, there's
blows
like,
it up.
It's something that like gets shattered, but then they basically, they make plans to actually like for like a date type
well,
thing.
Well, no, he calls it like he's like, I'm gonna ask you out tomorrow or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. And then before he leaves, he goes, stone fox.
Not a stone cold fox, which is how I felt like that phrase typically goes. Just right. A stone fox.
You're a stone fox. And he's literally thinking of a stone fox.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah.
And also props to the educational film they're playing, because it's all about the tempestuous like hurricanes and like there's all this mention of like stormy weather as they slowly build up to just that last part where he leans
and they're
in
like
out frame.
That's great. But and I just it does most of it in just the, like this like locked off static shot.
Yes.
And then you know he goes over to their house where he watches television with their family, not seated next to Lux.
Can I say that I've been in that situation?
And was it awesome? Awkward.
Huh?
Awesome. Yeah. Was it awesome?
It's so awesome. We watched such a cool Discovery Channel show.
That's great. Just watching leopards slaughter other animals on the savannah.
Yeah.
While the whole family's crowded into the room.
Yeah, and the dad's like, whoa!
And the dad's on his lazy boy.
The dad's asleep. James Wood is asleep in that scene also, and it's really funny. When Kathleen Turner goes, it's late, because she's trying to get Trip Fontaine out of the house.
Yeah.
And he's clearly asleep, but she goes, it's late, honey. And he hears the word honey and goes, mm-hmm, and just like leans in.
Yeah.
And then she just has to say it again. And he's like, knowing that he was asleep the whole time, she goes, I think it's a little late, honey. And he's like, oh, yeah, of course. Well,
it is late.
Let's get everybody out of here.
Also, I just want to mention, so James Woods' character is really into aviation and planes.
Yeah.
And there's this great part at the party scene earlier when he has like a few of the boys who are over and he's talking to them about planes. And like, this is the plane that like, you know, like helped win World War II and stuff like that. And then one of them is just like, I have to go over here. and then he leaves, and then another one just leaves with him. And there's one left who's like,
too polite to leave.
Yeah. And he just keeps talking.
Yeah. And also he's talking to his plants at the school. And he's like,
how? Photosynthesis.
Yeah, hey, did you guys photosynthesize your breakfast this morning?
Oh, he's so good.
He's really great.
And the teachers are like,
And just gets, they get so much good and comedy just from.
They get so much good wood.
Yeah.
Get out. Jake.
We're going to take a break.
We're recording in your home. Get out.
This is a good time to take a break.
And we should have a break here.
Yeah.
Did you hear a word from our sponsor?
And we're definitely not going to beat the shit out of Jake for running his stupid mouth.
Have a word for
this fucking guy right here. Hey guys, Patrick here. So we don't have any sponsors yet, so here's a message from us. We are producing this podcast totally independently, and recently we've been upgrading our whole audio setup, which means new mics, a mixer, all of that stuff. And so if you are enjoying this and you want to help support us and help make it possible for us to keep doing this, you should check out our Patreon at patreon.com/PatrickHWillems, which also goes to support the videos that you probably also watch every week. So go check that out, and now back to the episode.
And surprise, there was no sponsor because no one's sponsoring this podcast yet, and we are not making money off of it. But that could change if you represent some major brand and want to sponsor a podcast devoted to Josh Hartnett.
Sponsors won't stop us from loving Josh Hartnett. So.
Nope. If you do have money or no sponsors, please let us know, because we spent a great deal of money and time in making this.
That's inaccurate.
A decent amount of my personal fortune went into this endeavor, and I have not seen a return.
This movie is streaming on Stars, and I have a subscription, and so it didn't cost anything to watch it. Anyway, back to the man himself.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking Trip Fontaine.
Yeah.
We're talking Trip Fontaine, played by Joshua. The man this podcast is devoted to, Josh Hartnett. So,
Josh, if you're not here for him, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah. And so all you heartheads out there, this is why you're here. This is what you came for. And so Trip Fontaine wants to take Lux herself, mm-hmm. to the homecoming dance. And he has a master plan.
Yeah.
Matt, tell us about the master plan.
He does have a master plan, eh? Well, it's not to call it a master plan is a bit of a stretch, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's high all the time, so there's really only
his master
so much of a master
plan. His master plan is this. He kind of stumbles into it because he didn't really plan it. He just wants to ask Lux out. He suffers through a stifling evening of just TV and not being able to touch Lux.
Or even really look at her.
Yeah, because the mom is there getting mad every time.
And they're watching the TV.
Yeah. And she's watching knitting.
Violent nature footage, by the way.
To undergird the subtext and make it text.
Yep. Nice job, Sophia. Thank you.
Nice, dude. But then, you know, so they leave and she doesn't even really kiss him at the door. And he's like bummed out, but he's like, ooh, boy,
he sits,
I'm...
He sits in his car.
And he's stewing in his car and he's like, this girl doesn't... Fuck, I don't want to kiss her on the mouth. And then... Bam! She appears.
Boom! Out of nowhere, runs across the lawn.
Like a whirlwind.
Into the car, smashes her mouth onto his.
And they make out for a couple seconds, and then she just leaves and goes, I don't want to get in trouble.
And then he's like panting for breath.
Yeah, and Josh Hartnett is at the Tripfontaine, the you know, the steely cold Tripfontaine who never loses his composure. Is now officially discombobulated.
Yeah. He is so discombobulated.
Exactly. No other girl makes him feel like she does.
Mm-hmm. He's the luxiest man alive.
Jake, get out! Jake.
I forgot I got fired. Oh my god.
Yeah, Jake was fired. He's just been here now.
Like, on our break, we decided that that was just Jake's first strike, and he's got a second
one. I'm on a three-strike policy, guys, so I should... You know,
all right, you get one more, then I guess.
I'll behave.
But so here's what happens.
Straighten your jib.
Homecoming dance is coming up, and, you know, looking back, we all have our really fond memories of homecoming.
We definitely all went.
We were all cool guys.
I remember standing outside of that throng of dancers and watching the steam rise from the homecoming dance and just sort of sadly standing at the sidelines.
I remember how that dance floor felt on my shoes. Like a bag of sand.
I remember getting called up for the final song of the night, that slow song, and you would just dance slowly with your partner to Crash by Dave Matthews.
Yeah.
And I because come it, into...
It and I remember...
2005 or something like that.
As I remember when I took partner. My sweetheart out on the floor and Pony... The soft notes of the first notes of Pony... Came on.
Barrel. 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 The soft notes of Pony.
Pony.
Ride it. And I come into you. Have a good night, everybody.
And
but,
then when they wanted all the students to leave, they started playing Frank Sinatra.
But.
Sorry, yeah.
Back.
We
back,
all don't
he
like
begs.
That.
Trip so, begs so
Trip,
the dad.
Trip. He doesn't just beg the dad. He puts on his knight's clothes. He wears his full school uniform for the first and only time in the film so that he can speak to Mr. Lisbon after math class.
Yes.
And he's like, I would like to take Lux to homecoming. And Dad's still like, no.
Yeah.
That's not happening.
Yeah.
And then he gets a thought. He gets an idea.
Mm-hmm.
What if me and some... Oh, also, a way he wins over the dad, he's on the football squad.
Yes.
Not
squad.
Team, squad.
Yeah.
Squad is key. And, yeah, far before there was a Suicide Squad, far before there Taylor Swift had a squad.
Or there were squad goals at all.
There, James Woods was talking about a football squad.
Yeah.
And in the 70s. And so...
The Nostradamus of culture.
Mr. Lisbon.
Mr. Lisbon.
And so he likes Trip because he's on the football squad. And so Trip's like, what if me and some of my football buddies took all the girls? And that does it. That wins him over.
Mm-hmm.
The mom buys them some very conservative dresses and adds some extra inches to them just to cover every inch of skin.
Yeah.
And but they're thrilled. They all get to go. And he assembles a crack team.
He does.
Of anonymous boys plus Hayden Christensen. Yep.
Who all come with their trademark perk, like the car, the cool car to drive in, the drug hookup to some dank ass freaking weed.
Some dank nugs.
Dank 420, bro.
Oh, yeah.
And then Hayden Christensen for some reason, I think.
No, the third one is because he looks good because he like won the science fair or something.
Yeah.
Like, he's the smart kid that gives them credibility.
Right.
And there's also a good scene where Trip is like at football practice and he's like, all right, boys, who's coming with me to take the Lisbon girls to prom or to homecoming? And immediately I thought, this is funny because this is his movie after The Faculty, and at the end of The Faculty, he has joined the football squad, and now here he is on the football squad.
Right, the very disappointing ending of The Faculty.
Yeah,
where everyone's cool, interesting traits are completely stamped out as you conform.
Right, and it's like, what? Why is he playing football? Come on.
Yeah.
He should be a science nerd. He honestly, in The Faculty, he should have had like the C. Tates and 21 Jump Street arc.
Yeah.
Where he's like, wait, I like the science nerds now. I like doing this.
Right.
I'm a nerd. Not, I've been into science the whole time secretly and now I'm a jock.
He should have his Carlos the Dwarf transformation.
Oh my god. What? And actually, it's funny that you mention Freaks and Geeks because there is a big Freaks and Geeks connection in the scene we're getting to, where they go to homecoming.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah!
So they bring all the girls, and some of them
and
like.
And Tripp's got his trademark bottle of peach schnapps.
He's got his bottle of peach schnapps, but also
just love it.
But also, Lux is smoking with him in the car.
Yeah,
the drive over.
Looks like I don't give an F.
And her sister's like, "Mom's gonna smell it on you," and she'll be like, "Whatever." I'll say that someone at the dance was smoking.
Yeah,
because Lux doesn't give a fuck.
No,
he's going.
Whoa,
for
you
it.
Say okay?
Hey,
she doesn't give an F, but that's okay.
But no, we swear on this podcast.
We don't say the F word about it.
I will say a thing that I really liked when they're driving over. This is one of the rare times you actually get a sense of like the sisters as sisters, and so you have them like excitedly talking and like
they're gossiping and
they're
stuff.
Gossiping about different houses on the street, and the boys can't really join in because this is like them. They're their own little secret language.
They've finally broken out of this horrible, stifling home.
They can be themselves or some, like, version of themselves for, like, the first time.
I love that in that scene, though, you can tell the boys are sort of, like, smiling a little uncomfortably and, like, poised to want to say something. Like, their mouths are always, like, a little open, and they're, like, sort of turning back to look at them as they're talking, and then nobody ever quite comes up with something to reply with.
Yeah.
Well, it's but, funny, like, what I like is that the boys are, like, they're not... They're all likable.
Yeah.
Like, they're, like, good dude. Like, you expect, like, maybe some... I mean, the only person, right, is our boy Tripp.
Yep.
Who trips over his own freaking dick. Yeah.
So, are only on this is what we should probably mention. Tripp has a 4-foot-long dick. And like that's, like, his major character.
Yeah. 4 feet long. 4 feet long. 4 feet.
And that ends up becoming his downfall.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. Because, you know, well, this is the other thing is, right, like, so, I don't, how much more detail do you want to go into the, they, like, make out, and she drinks some peach schnapps.
Well, also, Homecoming King and Queen are Tripp and Lux, and they're hiding under a table, and they have to, like, get up out from under the table.
Stroll out
and,
casually.
Like,
straighten their shit.
Straighten the tie, and, but they're having a good time. Everyone else is having, like...
A fun, good time.
An okay time. But
Hayden Christian's, like, boring his date. He's like, sand gets everywhere.
Yeah. I hate
it's
it.
It's rough, of course.
It gets everywhere. She's like, I want some more fun.
And she's
the opposite
he's like,
of sand
sorry,
right now.
Lady. Whenever I think of him, I just picture him, like, smiling creepily and going, sorry, m'lady. But it's funny because Hayden Christian, he's, like, short here. Because this was several years earlier.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So, but then what happens is the rest of them all go home and they're like, where's Lux?
Mm-hmm.
And they can't find her.
And she's going to break curfew.
They've got a curfew.
Remember that. They got a big curfew because of Kathleen Turner.
Their mom is strict.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
right.
What else should I know Kathleen Turner from beyond Romancing the Stone?
Oh, God. I mean, she's so famous and I have no idea.
Yeah. Bad.
And it's a bad look, and I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah. But anyway, she's good in this movie. And,
so where are Tripp
and
Lux? They're wandering out to the football field.
I feel like she's always been this kind of person. Not always, but a lot, right? Like
probably. Well, because Romancing the Stone is the one thing that I can think of. And there she's like, you know, the uptight person, but then she loosens up because she's in the jungle.
Right, yeah.
Michael Douglas.
Oh, my God.
Good movie.
Sounds super hot, but we'll get to that one a little later.
Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
And and we should mention right now that when we finish We Heart Hartnett, we're going to launch our Michael Douglas podcast called We Dig Douglas. I take that, please don't take that seriously. That's not happening.
And we're gonna have the Dig Dug theme playing. Have like lyrics about Michael Douglas movies. And then, Wonder and, Boys and whatever. I can't.
Ant Man. Wall
Street. Wall Greed Street. Is good. And,
Money Never Sleeps. And then we're also just going to play Pokemon sound effects with Diglett Dig. Okay, anyway.
And Mr. Ding saying Douglas from Doug.
Back on track. Guys, back on track. We've got... Guys, we got some fucking to talk about.
We got some football fucking.
As in they do it.
Football fucking.
They do it.
As in they do it. Mm-hmm. On the football field...
Yeah. That Peach Schnapps did his job.
This is going off the rails fast. Bathed in the cool blue lights of Ed Lockman cinematography. But here's what's key. They have sex.
Yes.
And Lux wakes up the next morning. He's gone. Trip right. has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't she never see him again?
Nope.
No.
Because pretty soon after, she returns home. She takes a cab back to their house.
And
Mrs. Lisbon.
That cab driver never gets paid.
No.
I didn't notice that. She yeah. just steps out
it's like
and then...
He you can see him waiting as if she'd been like, my parent will pay you when I get there.
Yeah.
And then...
Kathleen Turner just slams the door.
Yeah.
He sees what's up. He's exactly. witnessing the
I think you can see his like hand wave yeah. like frustrated,
yeah.
but he doesn't get paid. But yeah, she returns having broken curfew, and the one time that they like were a little bit more lenient on the rules, like, okay, we'll let you have fun this one time. She broke the rules, and that was the beginning of the end.
Right.
Because Trip Fontaine does the classic shitty dude move of coming and then going, nah, I don't like you.
Yeah.
And then
he was totally an angel from season 2 of Buffy.
Oh. Yes. I don't know yeah. what that means.
And then, just like in season 2 of Buffy...
That guy looks like Billy
Buffy
Idol.
Lux got a rocket launcher and then shot him with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a part of... That's a spinoff movie called Trip's Fantastic Trip. The Fontaine of Youth.
Oh, my.
How come Matt doesn't get fired for his puns?
Because they fucking rule.
I get strikes
because
every time.
That fucking rule.
Oh,
yeah.
God. All right.
Yeah.
I'll do
I'm
that.
More exactly. talented than you.
Yeah, well... I'm gonna... You'll see... You'll all see.
All
right.
Jake will have his revenge.
I'm gonna be brooding on some puns.
Okay, but basically what happens here is there's a lot of you know, blue lighting
mm-hmm.
inside the house
mm-hmm.
as the girls don't really go anywhere. But one thing I found fascinating here, because like the boys are like watching them from across the street through a telescope in that classic
right.
way. Did you guys ever spy on people with a telescope?
Absolutely
no.
Yeah.
I did.
What the fuck, man?
Well, no, here's the thing.
Hey,
so,
did you see a murder?
No. I mean, look, you guys knew the house I grew up in. There
yeah.
was no one to spy on. There
yeah.
were just woods everywhere. But my family would go to Ireland every summer. And in one of my relatives' like vacation houses, not my relatives had like a lot of vacation houses, a single family of relatives, their vacation house... in the town of Lahinch in County Clare.
Mm.
They had a telescope there.
Mm.
And my cousin, who was my age, he just liked to use it to like look around. People are like spy on... Mostly they were on the golf course.
Yeah.
And
so
they'd spy on
cool.
people playing golf and then make fun of the bad golfers.
Wow, that's maybe the lamest user that ever... Look at his farm! Oh, Patrick, would
you need a sandwich?
There's only so much to do when you're like in a house and it's raining outside.
And there's people playing golf in the rain.
Exactly, in the rain.
That's, well, I mean, it's Ireland. It's like, you know, it rains like 60% of the time. No one's going to cancel a golf because it's raining.
Yeah.
We're not canceling golf.
Because of this rain.
Just for a little rain.
We're freaking canceling golf.
The grass is wet, so be it.
Guys, you gotta hit those soft tees.
Shit, tees. Sorry.
Better butter.
Butter.
I'm going to try these soft teas for a moment.
Softer.
Better.
Jake, yes. Softer.
So bad.
Softer.
Better.
Better.
I'll do it better.
Okay, guys.
There's runes on the sword!
Hey. Scotland?
Scotland! All right, anyway.
The tapestries.
What were we talking about?
The virgins commit suicide.
Okay, and we've now lost 70% of our listeners.
No. Hey, listen. So, the virgins... So the virgins are in the house. And
I'm not counting Lux.
Sans Lux.
Sans Lux. So, okay.
And she's just making out at this point, defiantly, on a roof.
So, yeah. Suitors come to her house and hook up with her on the roof?
Mm-hmm.
I had many questions about this.
Me too.
How is she contacting these people with her parents around?
Yeah.
How are they getting up to the... How are grown men getting up to the roof without being detected?
They'll find a way. If Lux is up there, they're just like, I don't know, but I'm doing it.
I'll jump really hard.
I believe it, but I was also just like...
You know how moms can lift a car up if their baby's in trouble? Your legs are really strong suddenly.
When Kirsten Dunst is on the roof and she wants it, you'll find a way.
When your horniness gets to a certain level,
your legs are so powerful.
You're capable of anything.
We should make an inspirational Lifetime movie about this.
Oh, God. Well, yeah.
So that's what's happening. Once again, the boys... This is where...
It's fine.
Trip is out of the picture.
Yeah.
He leaves... We see another jump forward to present day. Michael Paré is middle-aged, Trip Fontaine. And he's like... And he doesn't really give a good excuse for disappearing.
He's like, I love that girl more than anyone I've ever loved, but I don't know.
After that moment, everything changed.
I looked at her in the light of that field and I went... I felt nothing, and I just walked away.
Yeah.
And I was like,
and
what?
Never saw her again.
And never.
And now he's got to live with the thought of, maybe I'm the reason she killed herself.
Yeah, well, I think that's why he's an alcoholic, partially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And thanks, girls. Look what you did to him.
He does say he's never...
Poor Trip. He's still alive.
In that future segment, he does mention that he's never since experienced the same kind of level of emotion for someone, though.
But he had
right before that moment when it suddenly ended.
He was very into her.
But it also reads as kind of sentimental bullshit because when are you gonna, ever neurochemically re-experience your high school years?
Right.
When you're just, insanely into, a hot girl. It's pretty
very, very amplified.
Stripped down and basic when you think about it.
Exactly. Yeah, Trip, not the deepest of characters.
No. Mm-hmm.
And, but the best of the characters. But then, the girls are, they're shut off.
Yeah.
They don't go to school anymore. Mm-hmm. And the boys are really fascinated because they're like, what is going on?
Yeah.
We need any bit of information. And then the girls start, they know the boys are watching, and they'll find ways to communicate with them and send messages via, Morse code with, light switches. And then they apparently find ways to sneak out, and they'll leave little, notes. And stuff like that, which, thankfully, the boys find, because some of them, they'll be left on, the windshield of their dad's car.
In the middle of
what
the driveway.
What if dad saw that and was like, what the fuck is this shit?
Yeah, that sounds like Mr. Lisbon.
My boys.
You're right. The dads of the other boys. Sorry.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Also, we should just say we don't see much of them, but the families of the boys are just funny. And also, there's that one older single woman who just drinks her martinis alone in her ornately decorated house.
Yeah.
Always shot in these very wide shots so you can see the whole house.
You know what? I almost forgot to mention the other super strong parallel movie that I was thinking of the whole time was Ice Storm.
Oh, yeah. In terms of suburbia in the 70s.
Suburban, bubbling, roiling under the surface, suburban discontent in the 70s.
Yeah, and
the death of a child.
Death of a child and, young people's, emerging sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And, the fault lying largely, it seemed, with the adults who were, coming through... the 60s sexual revolution and cultural upheaval by overcorrecting in weird ways that were fucking up their kids.
I think the big lesson here though is that the Lisbon parents would never attend a key party.
I'm saying that made it seem like they made it through the 60s by becoming even more staunch in their faith.
Right.
And then felt vindicated probably by when did the Manson murders happen? I don't know.
1969.
Yeah. You know, one of those people that are see, the world is a dangerous place or whatever,
Yeah.
Because, when the girls are, discussing, gossiping and the boys are kind of in the car on their way to the homecoming and the boys kind of don't know what to say, to me that read as them finally getting a little bit of an opportunity in the movie to express their personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was like confounding to the young boys to see, because they all the girls were just ideas,
right?
And now they're like, kind of humanity is emerging, and it's weird, and you're like attentively listening to it, but also right. nervous that it's going to shatter the illusion.
And it's also interesting to us as the viewer, because it's the same thing. They've just been ideas this whole time, and that's like our first peek into their personalities.
So I mean, like, a lot of what it seemed like was just like, I mean, it seems kind of obvious not to be a hyper strict repressive parent, but like it seems like these girls learned, at least the youngest daughter especially, like, no one gives a shit about them as human beings or what they would want to be. It's all this like hyper curated environment for them. Mm-hmm. And maybe they felt like they just like wouldn't be able to get out of it. Cause every time they did, it was, people didn't care. Like Trip, you know, it was the catalyst for this. Cause as soon as he got them to break out of their shell, like it was just like, it was not what they wanted. I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm trying to justify the suicide of five people.
Right, but
well, Trip also triggered just like a renewed like sense of hyper security from their mom, who then decided it's like the best way to react to that. Yeah. Like, as an expression of like,
there's like
what
a dog
like to do
thing going on.
Yeah, right. Is to just confine them in a more deeply isolating sense in the entire house.
But I think part of it is that there is no simple answer to like, this was why. Because I mean, as much as, you know, there were shitty aspects of their lives, they weren't, you know, like, it could have been worse.
Yeah, and a lot of the shitty things about their lives are also very mundane and typical in, like, the sense that Kathleen Turner, Miss Lisbon, she's, like, an overbearing mother with really intense sort of religious, Christian perspective on morality and right and wrong and all that stuff, and she imposes it on her daughters, but that's not like particularly new.
They weren't being abused.
And she's friendly a lot of the time. She's not, you know, there's scenes where she's, you know, even when she's out and she acquiesces to Mr. Lisbon's like sort of suggestion to all have them go out to homecoming dance, she's out there getting the dresses for them, and even in that scene they're all having fun. You can see Mrs. Lisbon smiling, and they're like picking the dresses out.
It's not like
out.
This,
you know,
really,
she's not the most,
it's not a terrible relationship between the parents and the kids. And also the first daughter kills herself before the real like intense restrictions that's just part of it, that there isn't an easy answer to it, but anyway because we're leading right up to the end. The girls seem to be planning something, and they leave out these messages for the boys. Mm-hmm. And the message seems to be like, yo, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Please, like, help us flee this prison. And these anonymous boys who...
The boys
we don't really know all that well are just like, yes, we're gonna save you.
Yeah.
We're gonna help you get out of here. And they go over to the house at night. They're like, well, look, we got my dad's car. We got a full tank of gas. And we're ready to live our life a quarter mile at a time.
And fast car.
Oh, no.
Is it fast enough to drive away? Oh, no, we don't have to do it.
I know you love that song.
Yeah, I do.
It's a good song. But and then Lux is there, just hanging out downstairs. Just really chill, just being like, all right.
She greets him. She's like, you know, come on in, let's sit down in the living room for a little bit. I'll start the car.
Yeah, we should take our car.
Yeah.
And she goes off, and they're like,
okay, we'll sit
where's
here.
Where's where is she? Shouldn't they come back? And then they go, and they begin to think something might be a little bit off. So they go down to the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And this
this is also really morbid but funny.
This kind of is shot, it's like darkly funny and shocking, and is shot kind of like a horror movie.
Yeah.
Like with some of the
weird reveals.
Here. Yeah. And where like one of them go downstairs into the basement, and one of them's like, you know, walking around, and then the other ones see it first, and then he turns and he's right next to these dangling feet.
Yeah.
One of the girls has hung herself. They run upstairs, and then one of them like trip over the legs of another one who's dead, and they just get out of there.
Yeah.
And then they realize, oh, they also, good thing for the boys, because they could have
been charged.
If they had like messed up, they could have been like,
you know, viewed as like
murder
potential
suspects.
Murder suspects.
Yeah.
And so yeah, but they left no DNA at the scene.
I guess
that we're aware.
Oh, it's the '70s. Yeah. It's a little harder to get the DNA.
Also,
right?
Also,
I'm assuming forensics was not as good.
People had visited before. Sure. So, but yeah, but then they get out of there and they realize, oh, they all killed themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then
Lux ran the car and asphyxiated in the garage.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And they don't. They stumble on two. They stumble on the one that hung herself in the basement. They trip over the legs of the one that took sleeping pills in the kitchen. And then the fourth one, not Lux. She what?
I think she also took pills though.
Also took pills just upstairs.
Jake.
Wow, Jake, you really are fired now.
Okay.
Three strikes, you said, right? Well, that was three. The unholy trinity.
So close. I mean, it's a shame to lose Jake three episodes of this
podcast.
It is,
but we do have to be hard and but strong about this, you know, and Jake fucked up. And
exactly. We're trying to make the best podcast in the world. And you know, we can't tolerate bullshit like this if we're going to get there.
Really, and we are going to build the best podcast in the world, and I'll tell you why. Because we've built on the strongest foundation you can.
Josh Hartnett.
Which is the career of Josh Hartnett, which we asked someone recently if they even knew who he was, and she said no.
Guys, I'm begging you.
But then we showed her a picture of him, and she says, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What was he from? And then we told her, and she's like, I guess I saw that.
Oh, wait, no, I didn't.
And then she's like, no, I didn't. I think I just saw a poster for Penny Dreadful in the subway.
And that's when we realized, okay, I guess this podcast will appeal to people ages maybe 26 and up.
And I just thought, well, this is this way goes the Colosseum. That sentence didn't even make sense.
Guys, we're like at the end.
Yeah. Okay, let's wrap up.
Let's power through.
Let's talk about this final voiceover montage, basically, that recaps the fact that they... you know, cover the fact that the girls have all died, the virgins have suicided, and now...
Just imagine this is like a military thriller. The virgins have suicided. I repeat, the virgins have suicided.
And, you know, it's sort of like... this is where the movie does feel kind of abrupt, because we basically get, like, you know, the little Terrence Malick-y voiceover poetry stuff.
But it's Giovanni Ribisi.
It's Giovanni Ribisi.
He sounds like a young Goodfellas, like...
Ray Liotta.
Ray Liotta, yeah.
First of all, back so I can remember, I wanted to be a virgin who committed suicide. That was just...
I was like, well, we never figured out why the girls did it. Like, it's just, like, really weird.
Yeah. Unobtainium.
That's what the girls were to us. So go on, Jake.
Oh, no, I mean, I'm trailing off. I think the only thing I wanted to say about this movie was that you guys were sort of unclear, right? About
yeah.
Because it sort of fades.
Well, there's
to
also
black
little things, like, for instance, some of the boys start, like, you know, or like earlier on, start seeing images of the first daughter who
ghost,
killed herself.
Yeah.
Like, ghosts her. There's, you know, there's the sort of like. There's the big symbolism of the dead tree in their yard that like the town was trying to cut down, but they don't want it to be cut down.
And it's weird because the girl's story is never accessible, so like in a way it didn't really happened to them. Like it's like a thing that happened to the dudes in
the
movie.
Boys, yeah.
And like was not like you because you never learn why. And it's I guess it's important that it's a mysterious cause, but
right. It's just interesting because we don't really get to know the girls that well, but we also don't really get to know the boys who through whose eyes we're viewing the girls.
Yeah, exactly.
So everyone is in a way kind of unknowable.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the boys seem like they should be more knowable, but we don't also really know them.
Yeah. So my theory was just that Sofia Coppola made the movie wrong. She like made a huge mistake. No, that's not my theory. I just thought, like, when me and Rach watched this movie, shouldn't mention Rach because that makes no sense.
It's
Rach
Jake's
is
fiance.
Jake's fiance.
It's my fiance. Out of context, but yes. And so we were watching the movie together.
Sorry, female listeners.
Yes.
Yeah. Off the table.
We were watching this movie together, and at the end, you know, it fizzles out. And obviously, the big central question that most people watching the movie would have to ask is, like, what's the justification for the suicides at the end of the movie?
Right.
And so if they're not going to give you that answer in any clear way or give you like even really hints that are very, very strong, the assumption is that that's obviously not the point of the movie then. Like the movie uses that as just sort of like a way to maybe hold interest. Because, you know, if you add like a sad known tragedy that's going to occur by the end of the movie, but they tell you it at the outset, which is what this movie does. It gives you like this thread to hang on to as you watch it. And then by the end of the movie, when they don't answer anything, you're left feeling probably a little baffled and even like a little annoyed, like, mm-hmm. give me like a clear cut ending. But if it's not the point, then it gives you more room to start to parse out all of, like, the odd little scenes that you remembered in the movie. Like, if they clearly told you why they killed themselves, I feel like you'd forget stuff like the ghost of the youngest daughter or the weird sequence with the tree and right. all of these things that were intentionally brought into the movie that maybe have more to do with the actual intentions of
there's
Sofia
other, like,
Coppola.
Insinuations too, like the youngest daughter clearly has like clinical depression, and yeah. so like that's more obvious in her behavior.
Right.
But like, you know, Lux seems just sort of punky and defiant and like pissed.
Yeah.
And no one else seemed like they were like depressed in like a serious way.
Yeah.
So then this seemed like a symbolic act on their behalf, maybe incited by Lux. Like, there's, I mean, I guess maybe the fact that we're talking about all the possible theories is part of the intention.
Like I need to go read some like essays and think pieces on this movie just to see what other people have, like how they've interpreted it.
You can chime in with your thoughts, listeners.
Yeah, let it, like, pound off in the comments.
For sure. Well, don't say that about...
Pound off on your keyboards.
What are you, yo, guys, pound off about these dead girls and what you think about them.
But it is interesting also looking at Sofia Coppola's career that this movie, despite having surface level elements that are similar, and then also, you know, just being about young blonde women and stuff like that, it's pretty different than the rest. You know, it's more, I feel like it's narratively, it's more ambitious and more complex than anything else she did after, which are generally pretty simple.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know,
pared down stories.
Lost in Translation, Marie Antoinette, like, the, you know, even The Beguiled, like, they're all fairly straightforward.
The Beguiled being the closest, maybe, in some ways, to this movie.
Right.
Just for the sheer dint of having blonde women all cooped up in a house.
Exactly. And deaths. But it's interesting, like, you know, this was, you know, you can see connections to her other movies, but this is also very different.
That being said, like, there's no, you know, there's not always a necessity to thematically connect.
Oh, there isn't, but it's, you know, but it's almost like this sort of seems like a bit of a, like, an experiment for her, and then with her next movie, it figured out, like, she was like, okay, this is what I really want to do, and now I know how I want to make movies.
Yeah, because like Jake was saying, maybe jokingly, but maybe not, like, it is her first movie. She could have sort of nailed, like, she had, you know, familial access to some pretty talented, like, the DP and whatever.
Right.
But, like, she could have also just maybe fumbled it a bit.
I wish
I remembered the book better.
But
this
that's
is
also
what pissing
the thing.
Me off.
It's like, you know, maybe this is a pretty faithful, successful adaptation of the book. Maybe all the things that frustrate us about this are just present in the book as well.
Well, I just remember I was reading like a couple articles about this movie after I watched it, and
oh, guys, Jake read some articles.
I read a few articles.
Jake's
in,
a bit of a
in very well-respected publications about this.
I was feeding my mind earlier today.
You know, I was using my subscription to The Atlantic, and I was just like perusing their archives.
I was perusing their archives to find some old published critical reviews of Virgin Suicides from the 90s, and yes, so what they found about this movie was that possibly what the ultimate meaning of it all is the demise of innocence. Yes. So we want to talk about adolescence being a gateway through which innocence transmogrifies, if you will. I'm so sorry, guys. I don't want to do that anymore.
I felt like I'd cut you off.
I don't want to do that anymore.
The past hour and a half, so yeah. I'm glad you took it upon yourself.
I was just raring to go with that one.
But
did you have something to say?
No, I mean, like, no kidding. In a really general sense, people were just talking about how it was like that death of innocence thing, which is an old, you know, theme for a lot of movies
right.
to have, and like a really general sense, just, you know, the unknowable way that like the adults and the kids who are remember like talking about it 25 years later. So the perspective is from an adult too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all about how they can't like ever truly get like a glimpse inside of like the purity of like their own thoughts at the time, or obviously what the girls were experiencing too, because it's an inaccessible chunk of life that they were all experiencing, and then they crossed the threshold of, and now are trying to look back at it, and it's just as inexplicable as it was. They're never going to solve it, and so that's why they don't solve it.
They're worried about like the environment and stuff too. Like, yeah. It seems like they have a more like global perspective on tragedy.
Yeah.
And also, I guess the only thing I would have to contribute to that, because I don't really have any other thoughts on this movie, is that, you know, again, it might be significant that Eugenides is Greek. And that, like...
Is he from Greece?
I don't think so. No, I think, like I said, he's of Greek descent, but I think he's from Michigan.
Right, yeah.
This is all easily searchable, but I didn't do research.
Not like Jake.
No. Jake reads two articles. But I don't know if he... I don't know if he maybe... this is just a theory that he is drawing from just the classic sense of Greek tragedy, like, which is always super over the top, like...
Right.
Antigone and stuff, like people just, you know, Orestes, like people just gouging their eyes out and fucking killing themselves over like slights of honor and things like that. So I'm not sure if maybe that plays into it as well.
Follows the structure too of calling the tragedy out in the beginning, just to leave you with the sad feeling throughout it, even when
the inevitability of it, like, you know where it's all gonna go.
Yeah, you're watching the homecoming scene and everybody's having fun finally, but you're like,
and what is it?
I know what this movie's
called.
Air Supply.
Wait, who's...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the band?
Yeah.
Air.
Air.
Oh, yeah. Also, I realized, I never actually... I mentioned Freaks and Geeks. Well, you set it up, Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, yeah, go
for
it.
And I was like, well, Freaks and Geeks Connection, the homecoming scene at the, the final dance at homecoming is the slow part to Come Sail Away by Styx.
Oh, yeah.
Which... famously plays at the dance
in
at the end of the pilot in Freaks and Geeks, where Sam Weir enters during the slow part, asks Cindy Sanders to dance, and then the fast part kicks in, and he's like, "What? No, I want to slow dance."
Yeah,
and then one of the best pilots ever, one of the best shows ever. I love Freaks and Geeks.
How many hard-ons do you give this one, Jake?
How many hard-ons do we give The Virgin Suicides?
Out of how many?
No, we didn't have a scale. We just said if we liked it or not, I think.
Because
then we didn't want to keep track of numbers.
Yeah, numbers are too confusing, and then, we would win.
I'm dumb.
Not going to deal with that. But I give this movie, and in particular, Josh himself, a big hard-on.
Nice.
Yeah, a rock hard-on.
Yeah.
I think, this is the best thing we've seen him in so far, and I loved his performance.
This is a movie star-making performance.
Yeah.
Like I said, masterclass of a specific character type that he's played before, played to its perfection. So a big ol' hard-on for him as well.
Yeah, it's unanimous hard-on here.
Yeah.
And so great, like, if I were to watch this in 99 and I were my current age, I'd be like, man, this guy is really good. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see where his career goes from here.
Who are you, Josh, and where are you going?
And where does his career go? It goes to 2000s Here on Earth, where he co-stars with Chris Klein and Lily Sobieski, which we will be covering next time.
Boy, am I so excited for this.
Get hyped, folks.
We have not watched it yet, and we are real stoked for this.
Watch the trailer for this before you listen to this next episode.
We urge you.
This trailer is astoundingly...
I feel like we're going to have a lot to talk about here.
Until next time, hardheads.
And,
put on your hard hats.
Put on your hard hats, because this is a hard hat area.
So, for the end,
No, I did a sign-off.
Okay. hold on to that for a sec, because, let's tell the audience where they can find us in between episodes. Me, Patrick Willems. You can follow me on all the social medias at Patrick H. Willems. And watch the videos that I make often with these two guys at youtube.com/Patrick H. Willems.
Yeah, we're really good actors.
Yeah.
They're great. Great actors, great writers.
Mm.
Jake.
You can find me on Twitter at JRTorpy.
And you can also find me on Twitter at MatthewTorpy, TORPEY for both of us. I've got a webcomic announcement coming soon.
Coming soon. Could even be out by now. Maybe.
No.
Well, like, you can say it. You're releasing more more pages and installments of your ongoing webcomic.
About the Trix Rabbit.
It's really good.
It it's a gonzo dystopian, sci-fi epic about the Trix Rabbit and other serial mascots. You can find it at trixcomic.tumblr.com.
Right? And I've been practicing my... It's an excuse to practice drawing, and I'm getting pretty good hands.
You'll never make a career out of it when you're talking about it like that. It's genuinely good. Go read it. And you can tweet at us, ask us questions, follow us on Twitter at HeartHartnet on Twitter, and our twitter.com/HeartHartnet, and then email us. Send us some questions, requests, thoughts, comments, concerns.
HeartNet picks.
We're so few people.
No. Let me.
Sorry.
It is HeartHartnet@gmail.com. Guys, we're excited to have you listening.
Get in on the ground floor when we don't have any listeners, because we'll probably respond.
Exactly. Also, right now, while we're covering the popular movies, not the last decade of Josh Hartnett's career, where no one has seen those movies. Also, Josh, come on the podcast. Sponsors, get at us. And we'll see you guys next. We won't see you. You'll hear us next time. For here on...
I'll see you.